In the realm of Christianity, we have certain verses, people, and songs which stand out above all the others. Our favorite verse in the Bible is John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life." Our favorite psalm is without a doubt Psalm 23, which begins with those famous words, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." The most popular evangelist in the history of the church is surely Billy Graham, and our most famous and most quoted non-biblical writer would probably be C.S. Lewis. As for our most famous hymn, well, there's no argument and absolutely no room for debate. Without question, the hymn most loved, most sung, and most recorded than any other is Amazing Grace. What many don't know about this hymn is that it's not only the most popular Christian hymn, it is the most sung and most recorded song, period. When you consider all our earth's history and all the innumerable songs which have been written, sung, and recorded, there is no song that eclipses Amazing Grace. Most Christians could tell you that this hymn was written by John Newton and that he was once the captain of a slave ship, but few know much more than that. And that's a shame, since the life of John Newton is truly an amazing life, filled with amazing interventions from God. In short, Amazing Grace. It has been said that the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world, the idea being that mothers are major factors in the lives and destinies of the great and influential men and women who make a major impact upon our world. Surely this is also the case in the lives of the spiritual champions God has raised up throughout the centuries to bring blessing and transformation to both the church and the world. John Newton is a perfect case in point. John was born in the year 1725 into a prosperous British family, his father being a successful merchant ship captain. However, as a ship's captain, he was gone much of the time, and John's early training and oversight was done almost entirely by his mother. John would have her a brief 7 years, but in that short time she made a tremendous impact on her son, who would eventually make a huge impact upon Britain and the entire world. She was barely 21 when her son was born, and 27 when she died of tuberculosis. She loved her little boy, who was the only child she would have, and as soon as he was able to speak the English language, she took it on herself to give him a thorough education, in reading and writing, but more important to her, in the things of God. John's mom was a Christian, but not merely a nominal Christian, as so many British were in those days. She was a passionate evangelical who loved Jesus. She also loved the Scriptures, and she was determined that her son would share in those same passions. Her precocious son had a razor-sharp mind and was soon far advanced of ordinary children of those days. By the age of 3, his mother began teaching him to read, and within a year he could read nearly any book you placed before him. Believing in the importance of memorization, John's mama soon had him memorizing many Bible verses and passages, entire chapters of the Bible, hymns, catechisms, and poems. He had little interest in playing outdoors with other children, preferring his mother's company and attention above every other activity. His mother was the near-perfect spiritual mentor and teacher, and her bright son was a near-perfect student. Observing the happy, nurturing, spiritual, and tender relationship between a godly mother and her devoted and brilliant son, one might predict that this young man would surely go on to do great things in the service of Christ. And indeed, Newton did just that. But in between his mother's love and lessons, and John coming into a place of usefulness in Jesus' service, there was a terrible and miserable period of rebellion, and a truly wretched life that took John about as far as one can go into the depths of depravity, sin, and spiritual darkness. John was not quite 7 when his mother succumbed to tuberculosis, a common and deadly disease of those days. It rocked his world and changed everything. His father could not just drop his career and watch over John, so the young boy was placed in the care of others. His father soon married again, but things didn't improve much. John's new stepmother soon bore children and made no attempt to disguise her preference to her own children over John. His dad, who'd never been particularly attentive, seemed even less attentive to him now. Within a couple of years, John was sent to boarding school where he was harshly treated and his naturally tender spirit was crushed daily. It didn't take long for the boy to harden in such an atmosphere, and all the spiritual training of his mother seemed to dissolve. John developed a temper, became foul-mouthed and rough, and lived, played, and fought like most other boys his age. There was one difference, however, a strange impulse that would overtake John from time to time throughout his pre-Christian days. At certain points in his young life, something would shake him to the core, and he'd remember the God of his mother. He'd then make a sincere attempt to change and be a good boy or a good young man. It might last a month or several months, but it was never permanent. And when he gave up his attempts to be spiritual, he would revert to his former ways, and usually with interest. He would become a bit wilder, a bit more profane, and a bit more rebellious than ever. This seemed to happen at least 6 or 7 times from his boyhood up through his early 20s. John could never seem to totally escape the wonderful sense of God he'd experienced with his mother, but his flesh was too powerful and his heart far too strong for a mere wish to be better to accomplish the transformation he truly needed. By the age of 11, John withdrew from school and was allowed to serve as a cabin boy on one of his father's voyages. He took to the sea easily, and his bright mind enabled him to learn his duties quickly. His father apparently had no problems with John following in his footsteps as a man of the sea, and allowed his son to work for him on board his ships for several more voyages over the next few years. As John matured, he learned the ways of the sea, and also he learned the ungodly, profane, crude, blaspheming ways of the average sailors of those days. As he reached his late teens, his father arranged a job for him as a sort of plantation overseer in Jamaica. It paid well and was considered a high-status position. But something happened to change all that and turn his life in a different direction. What happened is that John went for a brief visit to meet some former close friends of his mother. He intended to stay a couple of days and be on his way. Perhaps he thought they could tell him a few stories about his mother, which his closed-mouthed father had never revealed. But while he was there, he met the youngest daughter of the family, a 13-year-old girl, and was instantly smitten. John was around 19 years of age, so to fall so deeply in love as he did with this 13-year-old girl was unusual, to say the least. John knew he could never tell her, her family, or his father what he was feeling. Not only was she too young for any talk of courtship, but by the standards of the day, John was not at this point any sort of marriage material, at least to any family of means. He had no money and no established job. Even if both he and Polly were in their 30s, the marriage would have been denied by the parents, at least until he could get and hold a good job and save up some money. So he kept his mouth shut. But what he did do was to stay much longer than he intended. Even though he could have no relationship with little Polly or even dare tell her that he liked her, he found rapturous delight in just being in her presence. A week passed, and when John finally forced himself to leave, the ship that was to carry him to his new position in Jamaica had sailed. Newton didn't mind. He was so enamored with his new love he couldn't bear the thought of working and living thousands of miles from her. He did eventually take a position with a ship which would be back within a year in order to make some money, but he wasn't about to commit himself to any job or career which would force him to go multiple years without seeing his great love. Polly's parents were not stupid, and it eventually became clear by John's continual visits that he had a romantic interest in their daughter. The mother liked John, who of course was always on his best behavior when visiting the family, but she made it clear they wouldn't even consider him as a possible suitor to their daughter until he could prove himself well-established and successful in a proper career. Being a lowly seaman did not qualify. On one of his walks from Polly's house, John Newton met a group of men who would alter the course of his life. They were sailors with governmental authority to impress young men into the British Navy. This was a sort of government-sanctioned draft, but instead of receiving a draft notice in the mailbox, these men would scour the towns and woods looking for fit young men to force into service. These unfortunate young men were shackled, taken to a temporary holding tank, and eventually put aboard a British Navy ship. There was no process of appeal, and no amount of protest made any difference. If you were captured this way and deemed fit to serve, you were in the Navy. In time, Newton found himself aboard a British ship headed out to sea. Having had plenty of previous experience on ships, he should have been a great catch for the Navy. but he proved to be a miserable conscript. The reason was his attitude. Although John could pour on the charm toward Polly and her parents, to nearly everyone else he was a thoroughly dislikable young man. He was arrogant, he didn't like to take orders, and his quick wit and sarcasm made him a pariah to the ship's officers. At first, Newton assumed he'd serve a couple of years and be released. But when he discovered the ship was scheduled for a long-term service to the Caribbean islands, and that he might not see England for 5 years, it was too much for him. He was sent on shore with a few sailors on leave. His sea experience and his father's request had made it possible for him to be a junior officer, and when sent on shore, it was his job to keep an eye on the sailors and make sure they didn't desert. But it turned out that Newton himself became the deserter. He immediately headed on foot to go and see his beloved Polly. He didn't get far. He ran into a group of British soldiers who eyed him suspiciously and soon ascertained that he was a deserting sailor. He was taken back to his ship, where he was publicly flogged in front of the whole crew, demoted to the lowest rank, and shunned by nearly everyone from that point on. The punishment was excruciatingly painful, and it took some time for him to heal and resume his duties. When he could get around again, his heart was filled with hate. He began thinking of ways to murder the ship's captain, but he also considered the very real possibility of throwing himself into the sea and ending his life. As he described it later, it was his love for Polly that kept him from doing either. Despite the seemingly long odds of ever marrying his great love, there still resided within him a flicker of hope that somehow, some way, he might be able to find his way back to England and have a happy ever-after life in marital bliss. His attitude did not change, however. If anything, he became surlier, more angry, and more thoroughly dislikable than ever. His heart was filled with hate for nearly everybody on the ship, just as much as it was filled with love for Polly. To put it in today's terms, he was a mess, spiritually, psychologically, and emotionally. In fact, he was so much of a mess, and his attitude so repugnant, that when the captain of a slave ship asked the Navy ship's captain if he wanted to trade any of his sailors for an equal number of men from the private ship, a frequent occurrence, Newton was granted permission to leave the Navy and join the private ship, which was carrying a load of slaves. Here, Newton did not fare much better, except that he managed to avoid getting beaten. Although the captain of this ship knew his father and seemed to like John initially, Newton's arrogant, defiant, rebellious attitude soon alienated this captain as well. It seemed that whatever ship he was on, he soon turned the captain and all the officers against him. Perhaps the best word to describe John Newton's personality and attitude in those days would be abrasive. The little boy who used to sit at his mother's knees and memorize poetry, hymns, and Bible passages was now a foul-mouthed, lazy, blaspheming, rebellious, hateful, cantankerous, obnoxious young man. Even among sailors, who are notorious for their profanity, his blasphemy and curses were shocking and unattractive. Anyone who came to know Newton well at that time would have predicted a short, miserable, wretched, and useless life for him. He truly seemed past hope.